This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. More than a billion people worldwide do not have enough to eat, and that problem is only getting worse. Some experts estimate that we're going to need more food in the next 40 years than we've needed in the last 10,000. Growing population, climate change, and increased demand for higher-cost items puts more and more pressure on the food production system. And even though we've produced enough food to feed everyone, the inequitable distribution means that many hungry mouths still go without. Joel Bourne is a contributor to National Geographic who wrote a cover story about the food crisis, The End of Plenty, in 2009. He's continued reporting on the food crisis and spoke this morning at North Carolina Agricultural and Biotechnology Summit in Raleigh and is with us now. Joel, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks for having me.
You wrote a pretty comprehensive piece in 2009 that talked about a food crisis, where we are and where we're going. That was 5 years ago. I'm sure everybody read it, and it's over now, right? It's fixed?
I wish it was over. Yeah. The big drought that occurred in 2012, you know, the worst we've had here since the Dust Bowl, it actually was preceded by three different price spikes after the big 2007 and 8 crisis. Now, what was interesting about those, you know, typically we have a drought, we have some bad policy, price goes up, and the next year it comes back down. And that just hasn't happened. The prices now are still double to triple what they were 10 years ago. Prices are still highly volatile. And as you can see in many parts of the world, they're causing civil unrest, whether it's the Arab Spring, the Syrian Revolution, whatever. Many of these have underlying causes of, you know, people just not having enough to eat.
All of this pointing to the limits of unending economic growth that's starting to pinch the global economic system. But one of the most surprising things about your piece and the aftermath is the productivity has slowed. You know, I grew up in I think we both may have grown up at a time when there was plenty of food around, productivity yields were increasing per capita, but we just couldn't get it to hungry people.
Right.
Even that's not true anymore.
Right. Well, you know, I was born in 62, right, in the beginning of what we now know as the Green Revolution, where Norman Borlaug and his colleagues created these high-yielding varieties of wheat and rice, and the productivity of those fields just skyrocketed. Yields tripled. I mean, it was just the most an incredible boost in productivity the world has ever seen. It was easy for, even though we, you know, our population has doubled, it was very easy for food production to keep up. Well, what's the problem now is even though population growth has slowed slightly, productivity of our agricultural yields has almost plateaued. A couple of crops, maize still keeps going up by about 1% a year. But overall, we're looking at 1% to 2% of yield growth, whereas population is still up at 2. So we're running into a deficit. And in fact, in 8 of the first 12 years of the 21st century, we actually consumed more grain than we produced.
This could break into a pretty simple binary, but I think a dangerous one. I mean, if you heard that now population is outstripping productivity, either increase productivity or decrease population growth or some combination of both. Are those the areas where we should be focusing?
Well, certainly we need to focus on productivity, which has completely stalled. And I certainly believe we could do a lot more to focus on the demography by making family planning services and birth control available to anyone who needs it. But right now, neither of those is happening, unfortunately. And the UN's medium projection for population growth is not 9 billion at 2050. It's actually 9.6 billion and continuing to climb to almost 11 billion by 2100. So we're going to have a lot more people on the planet to feed. And the agricultural experts that I've interviewed are saying we need to produce at least 70 to 100% more food in the next 30 years. So, I mean, this is a doubling of our food production, which is going to be extremely difficult to do.
Is it only a technological fix? You know, there was a time when the proponents of organic food and organic farming were told it's a sweet idea, but it's not going to feed the world. Can it, and is that an answer, or is there only a high-tech fix to the productivity problem?
Well, when you talk to the people, the big picture ag guys who look at this, they really say, you know, we're going to need every tool in the toolbox to get us from here to 2050 or even, you know, until population and demand starts to go down. But what we're seeing, of course, is increased per capita income, particularly in places like China and India. So it's not just population that's it's becoming a multiplier. It's that we're eating more meat, more fruits, more vegetables, more dairy that require more water and more grain than typically eating the food itself. Now, organic is the rage. It's growing at double-digit amounts probably since the early 90s. And yields, they're never quite as high. They're like a 6 to 20% yield gap on organic versus conventional. But it really depends on what crop you're looking at and where. Some crops like wheat or tomatoes, yield is virtually identical. You go overseas where they don't use a lot of irrigation or fertilizer, and the yield gaps virtually disappear. So, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, they've shown they can double their yields in some stations by using organic or sustainable methods of agriculture.
And, of course, the profit levels and margins go way up because you're using fewer inputs that are less destructive ecologically, right?
Yeah. I read one study from the USDA a few years ago said that, you know, there's been no study that has shown organic has made less money than conventional agriculture. Yeah.
So that's part of it. Then global warming, of course, climate change is also contributing to this. Tell us how.
Well, these are the stressors. I mean, used to be ag had a pretty level playing field. You know, we knew we needed water. We knew we needed arable land. We knew we needed a stable, temperate climate to grow most of our food. Unfortunately, we're running into walls on all those areas. Arable land, we're losing, you know, in America, in the United States, 1 million acres a year, something like that. Water is becoming increasingly restrained. We've got something like half the world's 2 billion or so people who are living in water-constrained areas. And, of course, climate change is throwing us a left hook. If we're now on course, if our emissions continue to hit between 3 and 5 degrees increase in Celsius by the end of this decade. Now, the Royal Society a couple of years ago had one of these big meta studies, and they said, you know, if we hit 4 degrees, then half of all of our current agricultural land will no longer be suited to agriculture. So, you know, as demand is just ratcheting up, there are all these extreme pressures that are pressuring our food production systems around the world.
Which, again, would argue for, it seems to me, a lower-tech fix for productivity. In other words, if you're using high-energy answers and high-technology and petroleum-based inputs to increase your productivity, you're just propelling the other side of the equation, which is the climate change issue.
Sure, and we have, you know, agriculture covers, what, 40% of our ice-free land area? It uses 70% of our water. So there are certainly, there are calls to basically recreate agriculture and make it climate safe, climate smart. If we can actually use some of the more sustainable ag techniques to increase carbon in the soils, you know, at least by even 10%, we could pull a tremendous amount of carbon from the atmosphere, according to some studies. So agriculture is the problem, or one of the problems. 20 to 30% of our emissions come from ag and deforestation associated with it. But it can also be a big part of the solution.
What about some of the structural changes? I mean, it seems to me that we may have to change the way we live our lives. I mean, what unfettered and unending economic growth has always meant to us is that whatever problem we solve, we can build our way out of it. If we've reached the limit of that, does it mean we're going to have to start burning fewer watts as Americans, look at a different lifestyle, look at a different way of financing technological change?
You know, whenever I think about these things, I think about Aldo Leopold, who came up with this theory of the land ethic. And he was an Aggie, you know, he was a forester. And it's this association we have with the land, so that every decision you make, you know, we need to think through our heads, this is going to be helpful for the planet, the climate, the food, or is it going to be harmful? And if we, you know, not just, you know, private citizens, but public citizens, governments, corporations, if they all sort of took that view, I think we'd be a lot better off because the consequences of inaction seem very, very scary and very worrisome.
It seems to me, though, you'd all have to be united under some kind of system, because if I'm a corporate decision maker, you know, one man's problem is another man's solution. So if I can externalize some of the cost of my production and that's allowed and I don't have to pay for those costs, it's not my problem. It's your problem as a government, right?
Sure, sure. Well, you know, big ag takes a lot of knocks. And, of course, I've written some things about them that they probably don't particularly care for. But, you know, the reality is they produce a lot of food. And so, you know, as a guy who came from an ag background, now a journalist, My theory has always been, you know, why don't we get these two guys together in the same room? You know, we don't have to make everybody be organic. We don't have to make everybody be big ag. But we can certainly utilize the best of both to create a system that works better for all of us. You know, let's focus on more on our results than on the sort of process that gets us to there. As long as the process doesn't do us any harm.
And you know? Demography, it seems to me, might be rooted in democracy. Allowing women a greater voice worldwide in reproduction could be part of that solution.
Oh, well, these are some of the great opportunities left on the table. And helping countries make the demographic transition is the best thing we could probably do. It has enormous benefits. It's simple. It's easy. The technology's been out there forever. If we do that, if we can make family planning services or contraception free available to everyone who needs it, we can hit the low population scenario that UN has projected, peak at 9 million, and then start to decline. So by the end of this century, we could get down to maybe 7 billion. So enormous opportunity there that yields tremendous benefits.
Joel, great talking with you. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Frank. It's been a pleasure.
Joel Bourne is a contributor to National Geographic. He spoke today at the North Carolina Agriculture and Biotechnology Summit in Raleigh. Just ahead, social commentary from a musical written in the Depression about World War I. Stay with us on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.